We'll move to the fourth case of this morning, case number 10-1139, Maddox v. Love. Mr. Ali.
Is it 4 out of 6 with Winston and Strong?
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Imran Ali on behalf of Manny Maddox in today's appeal, appellant. To put the context, this is an inmate religious rights case. I know Your Honor has dealt with a lot of them in the past. There are two decisions of the district court we are here to revisit. One is whether the court erred in granting summary judgment for the basis of failure to exhaust administrative remedies. Maddox contends that was error. Two, whether the district court erred in dismissing outright Maddox's claim that there was a budget allocation resulting in his services being singled out and canceled. Failure to state a claim, Maddox asserts that also was error to dismiss. Both of these issues are reviewed de novo. I will address these two issues in turn. It'll help to have a brief recitation of facts, so I'll refer back to those. Manny Maddox is an inmate. He follows the African Hebrew Israelite faith. He attended group services for that faith. In 2004, the services were suddenly canceled. Importantly, the way that Maddox came to learn of the cancellation was an internal TV channel announcement saying that the services were canceled until further notice. He thereafter completed a grievance form describing what he saw on the TV channel. The defendants explained that the cancellation was due to budget cuts. That's how they resolved the grievance, and Maddox filed a complaint including his religious exercise and equal protection rights. So going to that first issue, Maddox's request to overturn summary judgment for failure to exhaust. There are three reasons why summary judgment was improvidently granted. The first reason is that Maddox satisfied the requirement. Second reason is that Maddox had a form provided to him that was inconsistent with the new regulations. And the third reason is that the defendants had waived their ability to rely on failure to exhaust. As to that first reason, Maddox satisfied the requirement under the statute. This is the PLRA 504.810B, because he provided the information known to him. If he sees something on a television screen and he completes the grievance form saying, I saw this on a television screen, that's the information known to him. By the statute itself expressly has that exception to the naming requirement. In general, there's no doubt that there is a naming requirement, and in fact, there's no dispute that there is no name on the grievance form. But what also shouldn't be disputed is that the statute has an exception to that naming requirement, which reads, this provision does not preclude an offender from filing a grievance when the names of the individuals are not known. But the offender must include as much descriptive information about the individual as possible.
I thought he knew who was responsible, because didn't he have a conversation with the chaplain about this before filing the grievance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Asking, a follow-up question or two about why the prison was doing this?
He did have a conversation, Your Honor, yes, but not as to the details of why it was happening or the merits or to discover Chaplain Love's involvement in the decision. He had discussions with the warden in particular, and that's what the deposition testimony is, to say, this is what's going on, this is a problem, and the warden instructed him to fill out a grievance.
Okay, so he talked to both the chaplain and the warden, which suggests that he did know who to name and he just didn't do it. It seems to me the more pertinent question is whether there's been a waiver here because the grievance was adjudicated on the merits.
I agree with that as well, Your Honor. The reason I was referring to it here is because the statute requires it, and for purposes of summary judgment, it wasn't even addressed whether or not that was an issue that should have been resolved or not.
Right.
And to your point, there was a conversation, but there's no information and record evidence that the conversation included responsibility or that provided notice to Maddox that, yes, these were the people that decided it. For example, having a conversation with the chaplain about his services didn't reveal to Maddox, and there's no proof that it did, that the chaplain was one of the people involved in making those decisions to cancel his services. So there is a disconnect there, if slightly, but at least it doesn't rise to the level of satisfying this exception from the defendant's point of view. That's why it's raised there. Your Honor raises the waiver argument, and I reach that third. If it's all right, I'll just touch upon briefly the second of the three reasons to reverse summary judgment, and that is that Maddox filled out the form which didn't ask for names. And the reason this is important is because we have an issue of conflicting directives here, and there's case law, particularly in this circuit and in others. But the point is that if there's an instruction in a form that says, here's what it says, brief summary, that's the question. And it then later there's a, and that's the form that was created in 2001. And then later there's the PLRA adopted in 2003, which requires a naming requirement, but the form isn't changed in that period of time. How is Maddox supposed to know that there's an opportunity to put names when the instructions on the form says brief summary? That's a question of fact as well, and he raised that by saying he exhausted his remedy by filing a grievance during the summary judgment hearing, and yet that issue wasn't resolved in his favor either. So that's a second reason. Third reason, and I'll reach the one Your Honor mentioned, and it's the one I'd like to spend the most time on. The third basis for reversing summary judgment. The defendants acted on the grievance form, so they waived the defense. Now, attached to the complaint itself is the grievance form, the response to the grievance form, the appeal to the grievance form, and the final judgment on the grievance form, all of which say there was a budget cut, and so, unfortunately, the African Hebrew Israelite services were canceled. That's a resolution on the merits. The underlying policy behind this, the underlying policy is, the state has to have, and the defendants have to have, an opportunity to know what is the claim that's being brought against them, do they have the ability to investigate it, and did they investigate it? And if those answers, as they are here, are all yes, then they've acted on the claim, and they can't now raise, after the fact, that the form wasn't filled out incorrectly. From a policy point of view, it just doesn't make sense to have a trump card where the defendants can do what they want, act on forms that they get, maybe even recognizing there's a flaw with them, but instead of raising it to the attention of the complainant at the time when it could be fixed, acting on it in the merits, sitting idly by, and then when somebody calls them on it saying, we have this trump card, you didn't put the names or any other requirement that was in that particular case. That type of policy is frowned upon, and Ricardo, the Seventh Circuit, ruled that for the grievance has served its function of alerting the state and inviting corrective action, that is the purpose of filling out the grievance to begin with, and when that purpose is satisfied, there's no argument that there was a failure to exhaust.
If you're right and there was exhaustion, what claims survived that exhaustion?
The summary judgment claims, which were counts 1 and 4, as recharacterized by the district court?
Count 1 is no comparable access as other religions do. Religious materials. Is that really in that complaint that he filed?
It's not in the complaint and the grievous form. It's more, count one is an indirect relief request, because in the complaint and answers, reference is made to how the chaplain would bring materials with him to the services. And so that's really an indirect request.
It's your fourth complaint as restructured by the judge that you assert should come back from summary judgment.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. If count one were to come back, it might be dismissed for another reason, and we understand that. Count four is the one which is the central relief brought front and center in the grievance and in the later proceedings as well, not having access to a chaplain.
And that claim is asserted both as a First Amendment violation and a RLUIPA violation?
It was originally asserted as an RLUIPA violation, but the inmate has since been transferred to another prison. And since we now understand RLUIPA to be an injunction remedy only type of analysis, we're not seeking anything under that particular claim at this time. Now, I want to make another practical point about dismissal just to show you how strongly we believe in this, and that is that the district court granted summary judgment, but as happens in these cases, that's without prejudice. And there's case law that I've since read, and I wanted to bring to the court's attention, Walker v. Thompson at 288 F3rd 1005. And the point of that case is basically making different observations about the issues of mootness, issues of grievance forms, and basically points out that the whole point of a grievance form is if it's denied and the case is dismissed without prejudice, the inmate can still go back, correct the form, and start the process over again. It's not foreclosed completely from relief. But in this case, nothing would have changed. Say Maddox goes back in time, names the chaplain and the warden and the new warden. The same thing would have resulted. The state would have evaluated the claim, said, here's why we canceled the services. It was a budget reason. And the same thing would have resulted at the trial court level. And so it should be resolved on the merits. Reyes is a case also, it is a district court case in the Southern District of Illinois, which I understand is going to be before Your Honors soon, but it is actually on point for this reason, that it goes through the analysis that if there's an action where the state acts on it, then there's no opportunity to argue for a failure to exhaustion. And it just makes sense. There's nothing gained from an empty technical requirement if it's already been acted upon and it is ripe for evaluation on the merits of the appeal. Now, the question has come up about, did Maddox raise this particular issue about the reversing of the summary judgment for the basis that he completed the form and that it was acted upon? And he did. He argued in his summary judgment papers that his request was denied on the merits and, quote, services was canceled due to budget cuts, end quote. So he is raising this in the papers, and at the hearing, again on summary judgment, the issue came up again, raised by the defendants at length, saying that there was budget cuts and that's what created this problem, and they dealt with it by canceling the African Hebrew Israelite services. And then in referencing the chaplain, Maddox said defendants said he was a victim of budget cuts. And so this issue was addressed and resolved directly during the summary judgment hearing as well. And as a matter of fact, because it was resolved on the merits and the grievance form, that also was the result. It bled over into the dismissal as well, to give the judge an opportunity to evaluate the merits of the budget cut claim as part of the dismissal. And so for that reason, since it's already been ruled upon, Mr. Maddox contends that summary judgment should not have been granted and so should have been reversed for at least this basis as well, that it was already acted upon and therefore the failure to exhaust was waived. There is a second issue in this case as well, Your Honors. That second issue has to do with the dismissal of counts 2 and 3 of Maddox's complaint for failure to state a claim. Here's what happened. After the district court reorganized the counts and labeled 2 and 3 as sort of budget issues, that would be our shorthand for them. One was for the chaplain specifically, and one was for disproportionate allocations generally as to his religion. The reason for the dismissal was that there's no requirement to equal treatment. And that's true. Maddox is not contending there's a requirement for equal treatment. That's absolutely correct. Both sides agree, though, that the proper question should have been, and this is in the defendant's brief as well, whether Maddox pled he had no reasonable opportunity to exercise his religion. It's the Cruz v. Beto test. The answer is he did plead that. Here's why. In his complaint, he alleged he did not have the reasonable opportunity to exercise his religion. He even used words to that effect and used them referencing the constitutional standard from various cases.
How is that different from count 4?
It's different from count 4 in that count 4 had to do with whether or not he had access at all. So to some other, in theory, under count 4, you can imagine some alternative remedy could have been fashioned, such as group services by guard supervision, as had been done in other cases. Whereas count 2 and 3 is more money-focused, paying for a chaplain out of the pockets of the budget allocated to the prison. So there is a slight difference there, and that's what I believe the district court was making that distinction for. And as it turns out, Maddox's complaint did plead this, and in response, defendants say that Maddox really didn't say anything about the no reasonable opportunity to exercise. We tried our best to find what the basis for that would be, and it has to be that it's because when the district court reshuffled the counts, the district court didn't then go back and cut and paste all of the allegations in the complaint, just had summaries in the recast version just so that they could be evaluated in a little more efficient fashion. But when you go back to the complaint, as we must evaluate what Maddox's pleading included, it said, quote, the restrictions and cancellation of the African Hebrew Israelite services at Lawrence by the defendants were and are arbitrarily imposed and has put a substantial burden on plaintiff's right to freely exercise his religion. For that reason, the dismissal should not have been entered, and we ask that it be reversed and remanded. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Welsh.
Good morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the defendants' appellees. There are two questions, but there is no question, I want to say, about the RLUIPA. The plaintiffs realize that that's not appropriate. There's also no general question about, even under the Constitution, about declaratory injunctive relief, because that's moot. But in addition, the plaintiff, I thought, admitted in his reply brief that the grievance did not address the religious literature claim, and so that claim has been forfeited as well. PLRA exhaustion question has to do with the services. And this is substantively different, as the Court indicated, from the money, the dismissed claims, which have to do with funding. This claim has to do with denial of a reasonable opportunity to have services, not just services at all, because there's no constitutional obligation for us to provide services for every sect. The constitutional obligation is for us to provide a reasonable opportunity, and part of reasonableness has to do with availability of individuals and of funds. And again, here, with regard to that, the Smith claims, is that the plaintiff doesn't dispute this, the grievance indicates that his minister, unlike the other ministers, had been paid, and it was the budget cuts that came along and would put him on the same level as the other ministers, and he had been treated better, and now he was just being treated the same. But to go back to the PLRA exhaustion question, the plaintiff admits correctly that there is a rule that says he has to name or describe as best as he can, as much as possible, and also that his grievance didn't do this. And now plaintiff, at the hearing on the PLRA exhaustion issue, when he was asked directly, how did you exhaust your remedy? And his sole answer was, and this is at page 26 of the appendix, I exhausted my remedy by filing a grievance. That is it. He did not raise any of these other arguments that he put into his opening brief. And by not doing that, he deprived the court of its essential function of deciding these. And he also deprived us of the opportunity to present evidence, as happened in the district court in Reyes, when we presented, as we did here, the rule. And there the plaintiff presented evidence. He raised the I didn't know this rule, I wasn't told this rule defense.
What else would the prison have done in responding to the grievance that was filed that they didn't do? They determined that it was a budget decision.
I think what they would have done was, what happened here is the court recognized the plaintiff talked to every defendant, not just to Warden, Warden Garnett, not just to Chaplain Love, but also to the subsequent Warden Riker. So the plaintiff, before he filed his grievance, seemed to have identified the very same people he's naming as responsible in the complaint. If he had put in his grievance, I understand, I was told by Chaplain Love that this was due to budget cuts, then perhaps there would have been some further investigation to develop the record. Remember, one of the main reasons for the PLRA.
Some other reason?
Well, I don't know even now from this record who did the budget cutting. I don't even know who's the right defendant in this case from this record. And so, so there would have been, and again, in Woodard, the Supreme Court explained that one of the main reasons is for us to be able to develop a record in to figure out what the problem is and how to solve it. And he didn't give, the information he gave us was limited, and so we could only solve it in a limited way. Well, all we knew was that there were budget cuts. We found out the same thing he already knew. And so perhaps there could have been more information like such as who was responsible for the budget cuts. And so I think that that's the purpose here of the thing. But remember, this is, again, something that he didn't raise below. Similarly, with regard to the, you know, as I was saying, with regard to the rule, we could have presented perhaps a handbook showing that, unlike the plaintiff in Reyes, he, in fact, signed off on a handbook that said, you know, I know that this is the new rule. Maybe the grievance officer, when he hands out the form, says, don't forget, you have to name everybody. We don't know this because he didn't give us the opportunity to present this evidence below.
Well, it's your burden to prove exhaustion.
Right, but we did that.
Exhaust, I should say, as an affirmative defense, and it looks like he did exhaust because the prison adjudicated this grievance on the merits, which under our case law constitutes sufficient exhaustion, and we get to the merits.
Actually, Your Honor, that's not true. With regard to the case law, the only time it's come up so far since this, the only time that a grievance has been found to be exhausted without going with the rules is either on timeliness or when there was no rule about factual particularity. Remember in Ricardo, and I think that this is really important, you know, the plaintiff relies on Ricardo saying that the alert function is all that you need to do, and that's what Ricardo stands for. And Ricardo is my case, so I know that that's not true. In fact, Ricardo says, when the administrative rule book is silent, a grievance suffices if it alerts the prison to the nature of the wrong. But here, the administrative rule book is not silent. We showed that. And once we showed that the administrative rule book was not silent, it was up to the plaintiff to come up with counter evidence to show that either he didn't know about it, or that we had addressed it on the merits and therefore we had forfeited, or, you know, he didn't know, or he'd satisfied, or whatever other things he came up with on appeal.
The grievance form, which does not inquire the who, what, where, and when.
That's because the rule doesn't. Certainly the rule is available in the prison library. But in addition, there's no conflict between provide a brief summary. That's who, what, where, when. Everybody knows that. And provide and say who, what, give us the name, place, date, all of those things. There's, you know, the conflicting directive cases are the cases that say you don't need to appeal this anymore, or, you know, you can't file a grievance until there's an investigation, and in fact they could. I mean, that's when there's a conflicting directive. Here, in fact, a brief summary just means tell us who, what, where, when. I mean, that's what every summary does. So there's no conflicting directive here. But again, none of these were presented in the district court. The plaintiff's position throughout was, I filed my grievance, therefore I filed this grievance, therefore I exhausted on all my claims. And that's simply not true. And in fact, what it means is that this grievance didn't address the religious literature claim and didn't address the unequal funding, either the disproportionate funding or the unequal compensation claim. So those claims would also go out on PLRA exhaustion. Now, but without prejudice as opposed to with prejudice. And now turning to those claims, they went out on screening. We presented nothing. The district court did this itself. It divided the case, the claim, into four separate claims. One was the denial of the services at all. And one was the denial of religious materials, when in fact there's which he did not grieve, and then the two claims with regard to funding, and those claims, separate and apart from the no services claim, which went out on PLRA exhaustion, are, you're not funding my guy, you're not funding my minister the way you're funding everybody else. And you're giving my religion a disproportionate amount of money. And those are those, that's the nature of those two claims. Again, separate and apart from the claim that survived the screening, the PLRA screening, and then, you know, went out without prejudice on PLRA exhaustion. So here, I mean, there's simply no question that a bare allegation of disproportionate funding or unequal compensation with regard to a particular religion doesn't state a claim. Even under the old, the Conley version, it wouldn't state a claim. And certainly with regard to Turner and Cruz alone, those cases tell us quite clearly that you have to have more than just a claim. You have to say that that this kind of funding is unreasonable. It's unreasonable under a Turner analysis for them to do this. And what we know from the grievance is that the plaintiff's minister, unlike the other ministers, was paid. In fact, he was getting a benefit to his religion. And what happened with regard to the grievance tells us that his minister was now put on an equal footing with the other ministers. So I think, again, just to sum up, with regard to the PLRA exhaustion, no reasonable person could find from the facts that the plaintiff presented that he exhausted all his administrative remedies with this particular grievance under the law, under the rule that applied to his grievance. And he cannot raise on appeal for the first time these defenses to the PLRA exhaustion inquiry. And with regard to the screening, the plaintiff failed to state a claim because all he has are bare conclusions of unequal payment to his minister and disproportionate funding for his religion. And under the Iqbal Twombly, you can't just plead conclusions rule, plaintiff failed to state a claim, and thus the district court's dismissal of these claims should be affirmed. Unless the court has any questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ali, you've got 1 minute.
Your Honors, in my 1 minute, I'll address the PLRA exhaustion issue this way, that although counsel says something might have been done differently, in fact, that doesn't get to the merits of the claim. Even though somebody else may have been ultimately responsible for the budget cuts, that's not the issue. The issue is, how was it the budget cut implemented at the prison? It was by singling out these services, which the chaplain did, and that's what the information is in the allegations. And as to the knowledge of the names, by the way, I do want to point to the record of 823.1 at pages 21 to 23. That's where the pages are about who he talked to when. Nobody said, except for Garnett, that was the only person that he had talked to before the grievance was filed. There's an open question of fact as to the other individuals, particularly the chaplain. As to the failure to state a claim, those counts, Mr. Maddox is a pro se inmate. He did the best he could under the circumstances, and he actually satisfied the standards, even the heightened standards, under Twombly and Iqbal. And he did that in paragraphs 18 through 20 of his opening complaint, where he spelled out exactly what the standard was, expelled out why that his particular religion was singled out, and that his right to freely exercise religion had been infringed. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. And, Mr. Ali, you and your firm were appointed by the court to represent the plaintiff in this case.
Your Honor, we took it pro bono. It was referred to us from another agency in the area.
We have the thanks of the court for your fine service to your client and the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.